Welcome to The Hustle, a podcast about product design. Today, we're here with my new friend, Ben Johnson, CEO and creative director at Elegant Seagulls. Hey, Ben.
Hey, how's it going, guys? Thanks for having me.
Rick and I are really excited to have you here today. I'm glad that you were willing to do this with us.
No, I'm honored. Big fan of what you guys are doing over there and just excited to be a part of the podcast, and hopefully I can shed some light and on a few of these topics.
Yeah, I mean, you do killer work over there, and you know, we're big fans of what you do as well. We didn't get a whole lot of time to, you know, catch up at Epic Currents, but I'm glad we at least got to meet each other and hang out for a bit. Ben, why don't you take a moment to introduce yourself to our audience and talk a little bit about you and your company and what you guys are doing over there at Elegant Seagulls.
Yeah, like you said, I act as owner and creative director at Elegant Seagulls. We're a creative agency in Marquette, Michigan. We are going to be approaching our 10-year anniversary coming up here this summer, so super excited about that. Started as just a really small firm, just myself, more creating a job for myself versus creating an agency, and evolve from there. But we really try to tackle more creative projects. The more creative, the better. And one of the things we really try to specialize in and focus on is injecting personality into each and every design that we create. And yeah, it's been a wild ride, but I've been loving it.
What kind of work do you guys specialize in?
We really don't have like one particular vertical. So we work with all different industries, but we really lean towards people that are trying to break the mold, do something a little different. So we really look at projects like fashion, action sports, outdoors, areas that we're passionate about, and just clients that we really align with that want to break the mold and push their brands and push their storytelling. And so as long as we align on kind of that, those are the clients we're looking for.
So before we actually get to talking about the project work, if that's the kind of stuff that you guys seek out, how do you understand the story that they're trying to say and determine how that fits into a possible cultural fit or fit for your agency?
It's a good question. A lot of it is just listening to the clients, the whys, you know, what are their problems? If we can really sit and put ourselves in their shoes and figure out what their problems are and what the day-to-day is, we consume people here at Seagulls. We really try to understand people, and I think that is going to dovetail into some of our future discussions here in this podcast. But the more we can kind of understand the client and ask the right questions and read between the lines, is going to really make sure that we're going to align as we work together and try to solve their problems.
What kind of, hey Ben's, Rick, what kind of stuff do you look for then? Like when you said you try to listen to him, listen for the why. Like, what's a good why? What's maybe what's a bad why?
Well, I haven't 100% figured it out. When I do, then game over. But because it's still sometimes you think you've got it figured out and you're just not right quite on track. But the why is we get a lot of businesses that want to stand out, and they're currently looking the role and looking the part of all the other businesses in the industry. And their goal is to do something different. And so if they are coming to us and we ask them questions that are leading them to wanting to explore some new options and set some trends versus follow them, then those are clients that we right away gravitate towards. Mm.
So typical client, or atypical, I guess, comes in and is like, look, we just need a marketing site. We'd love it if you would use the, I don't know, Bootstrap or whatever, and just get it to be like parody with what other people are doing, this sort of like opposite of the type of work that you're looking for.
We still do those projects, but it kind of goes to some of the roots of how I think we evolved into doing more progressive work. Was we always would typically do two concepts. So we would do a concept A that was very much what the client asked for. The client wants blue, gray, traditional, standard, you know, and we would still try to meet all their goals and factor in all the ins and outs of what they're looking for and really make something beautiful for them. But we would also do a concept B where we put our own twist on it and where we really try to, are more reading between the lines and how will we tackle it if it was our own business. So each project that I do, I will not put it out there unless it's something that I would say was my own business. So that's where we started evolving this concept too early on in Seagulls, where we had a more progressive, more unique, more outside the box, something where we pushed ourselves and we were pushing the client. And it was really interesting that 80% of the time, the clients were not expecting it, but they loved it and would start gravitating towards it. And that really helped progress our work early on. So that taking that risk and going for it with that concept. So I don't stray away. We do a lot of projects that a lot of people would look at and probably say, this is not exciting and we do not want to do this. But if how can we take that and look at that challenge and make it exciting and make it interesting? If you can solve that riddle, then you know it's. I think it's an amazing feeling and something that we try to do.
How do you get your team on board with stuff like that? You know, like like how do you get other designers excited about something that's not traditionally or immediately exciting?
Yeah, it's part of just building the culture of that here at Seagulls. I would like to think I lead by example for that and pick people who want to challenge themselves and want to evolve and can think on their feet and roll with it and find pride in doing tough tasks like that that not everyone can do. So I do a lot of that from grooming people early on that have been at Seagulls and also just instilling that in from day one. And the people here have just sort of, it's become part of what I think makes us great and has built over years and years and years of more and more employees and everyone adapting that. So it now I don't think it's much of a downside. It's just a challenge.
That's interesting. You know, we were talking about empathy, like not just empathy of the end user or the end customer, but also being empathetic of the customer or the customer's team, customer business. I'm sure there's a lot of overlap there, right? Because, you know, sometimes it may not be, well, sure, like, we, you know, sometimes there might be like a design opportunity to really do something new. And sometimes, regardless of how exciting the project is, I mean, even the most exciting project, the real one other real opportunity is to build a relationship, a trust with that client. Sometimes the trust is there on day one. Sometimes it takes a little bit of time, but when you can kind of help them create wins in their own org or on their own team, and you know, sometimes they start opening up and letting you, you know, push the envelope more or things like that. And maybe share a little bit of your thoughts on that, because when we were talking about topic for day today, empathy with customer was something that you seem to be pretty interested in, and I'd like love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I feel like I've always had a pretty good read on just people and getting to a good grasp on someone really quickly as far as who they are, what they're about, and what makes them tick. And so being able to put yourself in that person's shoes and live their life for even a second is going to make you have that much better grasp on what they're trying to achieve. And so that empathy for the client is going to give you a better insight into the user as well, because I can't really probably get as good of an insight into that person's business without their help and their guidance. So you just really have to strip back a lot of the layers of you and yourself and then put yourself in the shoes. And it's tough. It's not always easy. And some clients are a lot, you can align right away because you have similar backgrounds and similar beliefs, but other times it's a trickier problem. But if you can do that, it just makes it so much better. And it makes your designs evolve so much quicker.
So you've developed a skill for doing that. You're running an agency. How do you help all of your other designers do the same thing? Or do you have a formal process for that? Like, is that, are there things in like kickoff and discovery where you have activities, or you're actually intentionally trying to learn, get into the shoes of those, the organization or the people? Do you, or I mean, or even more far-fetched, have you ever done a persona for a customer? How do you help your team grow in the, in those, developing those skills that you have?
The answer to that is probably lackluster and not what people want to hear, but there's really not a secret ingredient to it. A lot, it's just for myself, it's instinct. I just, yeah. it's just doing it and through practice and trial by fire and taking those risks. And, but as far as the team, it's me guiding them through each piece. So our junior designers are going to work much closer with me than our senior level designers. And I also try to attract talent who I feel has those character traits similar to I do, as far as being able to read between those lines. So I hire a lot based on personality and based on character traits. I can tell within literally 2 minutes if the person is going to fit or not. Their work could be amazing, but they wouldn't work within our organization because they don't have the right character traits to fit into what makes Seagulls great. So they could be a great person still too, but they might not have that looking for that intrigue of what makes these companies tick.
So when someone's not a good fit and you're 2 minutes into the interview, do you just stand up and walk out of the room?
I just throw down my pad of paper. I said, this interview is over. And I just walk out. No.
Perfect.
No,
perfect.
I mean.
No. That was a joke, obviously. No, can you actually give us a sense of what your current team is like? Like what, how many designers, engineers do you have? And are you guys a distributed team, or do you guys have an office, or can you tell us just a sense of what your team looks like?
Yeah, no, that's probably a good, helps with this. Some of the whole pieces of puzzles, everyone here minus one person is in house. So okay. We work very closely together, which helps with me being able to be highly involved in all the projects. And our one employee who is not here, Chris LaRose, crazy talented designer and dev, has been with the company for a few years as an intern to a part-time employee to a full-time employee. And then he moved to another part of Michigan just for family reasons. And so he already has a very close working relationship with me and the team. So it was an easy transition. But everyone else is in-house, and we have a balance between design and front-end dev. We really don't do any heavy back-end stuff. It's basically creative and digital, mobile, and web, and that's pretty much it. And so our skills are very focused, and so a lot of the team does both front-end dev and design, and then a handful of the team is just design, and then I act as creative director. We have an art director, Miles, and then John is our project manager, and he works with me on a lot of the biz dev and just sort of running the show, as they say.
Okay. Two follow-up questions to that. Number one, like, can you like, how many designers-ish are they, and how do you kind of construct your teams? Like, is there like two designers per project, or how does that work?
Yeah, so I should have, there's 9 of us total. So we're small agency.
Okay.
And the projects really, some of it depends on the size of the project. So, but typically we'll have at least 2 designers on a project, and that's where we still use that A-B concept. We usually always do 2 concepts for every project, and we'll probably do a lot. We'll probably do more concepting internally, but we'll present 2 concepts to the clients. And so we've continued that since day one, and it's just has worked for us, and we kept it going.
Did you say you guys are in Michigan?
Yep. So Marquette, Michigan, it's the biggest city in the Upper Peninsula. So if you hear a small hint of Canadian accent in my voice, it's not Canadian. That is upper. That's Uper. That's a little Uper accent for you.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Boot.
Yeah, people catch. People. It's so funny. I've had clients be like, "You sound like a surfing Canadian." So and then when I used to snowboard a lot, I'd be up Mount Hood, and people thought I was from Canada. So
yeah, that's funny.
We're way up north.
Something we've been, for some reason, actually ever since Epicurrents, we've been sort of like, the discussion's been floating around a little bit about just geography and where you're located. When I think of Michigan, I think of cold.
Yep.
I think of Great Lakes. I think of close to Canada, but I don't think of design. How does where you guys are located, affect your business? Is it, can you just talk about that for a second?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. One of the items I think really helped us early on was because we were isolated, we were pushing each other internally. We had a great team of designers and we were very, very competitive. Friendly competitive, but competitive. And It was always whose mock's gonna get picked and who can do the coolest new thing and who can, you know, and it was fun and it still is fun. We still have that similar vibe here now. But that progression, we were sort of on an island and we had no idea besides what we'd see here and there online if what we were doing was, if we thought it was cool and clients thought it was cool, but as far as a grander audience, we had no idea, which I think really, really pushed us and helped us. We weren't necessarily like the Bay Area sometimes is on its own island and it's the Bay and you gotta do what everyone there is doing. And we weren't really following that. So in that regard, being isolated helped us. But a lot of then when Dribbble came out and some of the other design social networks, that changed the game a bit for us for the better from an exposure standpoint. But as far as communication goes, it's never really been an issue. You know, we were with clients all over the United States and internationally. We're working with clients right now in Australia. We've got obviously clients West Coast, East Coast. We probably don't even do that much in the Midwest, so it hasn't hindered us.
That's awesome. I mean, I've seen your work. You guys are, you know, everybody knows that you guys do incredible work, and I personally think it is fantastic. So I think I was kind of wondering if just does where you guys live. Do you think that the culture or anything like that, does where you live inspire you when you're designing? Does it come into the picture at all?
Yeah, for me it does. I'm actually glad you asked that question because the wilderness and outdoors and being away from the city is a huge inspiration for me. Being in the woods and with my dogs and hiking around and it's quiet, I don't have my phone, I'm not at the computer, I'm in nature, is a huge, huge inspiration for me. I don't draw a ton of inspiration from other people's web work. I do. I'd be lying if I said I didn't, but I draw more of my inspiration from nature and art and probably non-traditional design or print design or magazine, you know. So I don't necessarily look at other websites when I'm trying to get inspiration for my own websites.
That and that perspective and that experience, I'm sure, does not hurt your ability to attract like-minded clients that are looking for that, you know, unique angle, you know?
Yep.
Yeah, because it's easy to say we want X and it looks like X, but if you want something that doesn't really exist yet, that's where I get excited. I get fired up about those projects and I love that. That's what pushes me and that's what I talked about earlier, trying to just like lead by example, is I put pretty high standards on myself and I try to always do something new for myself personally in each design. So every single design I'm trying to integrate something that I haven't done before. And it could be super tiny. It could be a button. It could be a footer detail. It doesn't have to be something drastic. But if I'm not progressing and doing something unique and different with every single one of my mocks, I just don't want to stagnate.
Do you think the clients benefit from you wanting to do that for your own design sensibility?
Oh, that's a good question.
I mean, like, because I do that too, but I'm wondering, like, sometimes, like, okay, am I doing this for me or am I doing this for the client? Or is it just sort of something that's happening?
A little of both. Part of it is probably selfish reasons.
Sure.
Part of it is, I would hope clients are coming to us now because they respect our work and our process, and it's been working, and a lot of our clients now trust us far more than they ever did before. So a lot, most of them will come to us and say, we want what you guys do, do it for us. So that's been a huge shift.
Is it a fair assumption to say that your shop and your work is known for great storytelling?
I hope so. If people say that, then that made my day. So I'd love, if it's not there, that's what my goal will be. I feel like we build very beautiful, responsive sites. But if we were going to put one piece and nail down one thing that makes us unique, I would say it's the storytelling piece.
So there's two really exciting things to talk about there. And we can, you know, I don't know if it matters what order, but your personal website is a story in itself. I mean, you know, tell us about Jack Dusty. Tell us that story. And then maybe let's talk a little bit about how you got, when you have, now that you found the right client that aligns with your values, it's going to let you create the next big new thing and really flex your muscles. Like, how do you bring storytelling into that experience and in doing the work? I'm really excited to talk about both of those things.
Yeah. Well, the Jack Dusty experiment, kind of came out of nowhere and grew into something far different and I guess bigger than it was originally planned or anticipated. So I remember Tobias, I always say it wrong, had said something about, you know, if you look at someone's portfolio and you see 10 iOS designs, you can guarantee, you know, what that next person's project's going to be. It's going to be an iOS design that's very similar. And that struck me, and I was already working on the Jack Dusty project, but it just became more of a realization that I wanted to do the work that I wanted to be doing. And I felt like I was having less time to create my own designs hands-on. I was very involved in all the team's projects, but I was less and less designing myself. And I didn't want to lose that. I didn't want to stagnate. And like I said, I wanted to make sure I'm always progressing. So I gave myself the challenge of doing one design per day. And that's where the Jack Dusty experiment evolved from. And there was, when it first started, there was not a lot of plan or strategy. It was just, I'm going to take a site I feel could use some TLC and I'm going to put my own twist on it. And that was it. That was the whole process and thought behind it. And just to be creative, as creative as I could. There was no limitations. I didn't really put any kind of set standards on myself besides to tell the story and go for it. So take risks and go ham on this thing and have fun. And so the first one I did, the Nyjah Houston one, I looked at Nyjah's site and I loved him as a skateboarder and what he embodied and his personality and his personal brand. And it wasn't reflecting through the site. And I said, this is it. This is my first one. And once I had the first one off the gate, each one became a little bit easier and the storytelling piece became more integral because I love the idea of tying these athletes to the products they represented and the sports they represented and making it one intermingled thing. Not every Jack Dusty I did was a athlete and brands that they represented, but about three quarters of them were probably in that vein. So, and then just experimenting and pushing myself. And I was so intrigued with this different grid structure. And I'm probably more interested in the negative positive space relationships versus the designs themselves. But that really became almost an obsession for myself throughout the process and really helped me grow as a designer. And we started picking up projects then where people said, we saw X, we want that. We saw X, we want that. And so we were picked up projects where people basically just wanted the design and just to swap in their pieces. So we did some work, some of it I can't say what it was because it was behind the scenes. We did some work for like a surf company because they saw the John mock, and we did a couple other projects that were direct. They saw the Rick Ross one and they said, hey, we love this, can we just have it? And we're like, so I was like, no, but we can do something for you. So it became a very cool networking tool and just a personal progression for myself. And I just kind of try to keep it fun and light. So if you read it, it's half man, half mermaid, and it doesn't really make sense, but it's just supposed to be for fun.
So it started out as a, you know, from what I understand, it started out as a, an outlet for you to continue to grow.
Yep.
And in what you just said, it seems like it's resulted in a lot of awareness in both you and the company.
Yep.
What is behind the name Jack Dusty? Like, is that a nickname or is that just, you know, like, what does that mean?
So where it came from was I was trying to help my sister-in-law come up with a name for her hair salon. And I looked up nautical terms and I found the term Jack Dusty. And Jack Dusty was, it actually came from the term Jack of the Dust. And Jack of the Dust was the guy who made the bread on the warships, for the British warships. And so he was dusty because he had the flour. Yep, so he was called the Jack of the Dust. And I just thought Jack Dusty sounded super badass. So I was like, man, Jack Dusty, game over, nautical theme. So I just decided that was going to become my alter ego for this project. And I had bought the domain I'm Jack Dusty before I'd even started the I'm Jack Dusty project. And then it just became a living, breathing thing. And it went from there.
Is Elegant Seagulls a nautical reference as well?
No, Elegant Seagulls was a funny oxymoron, and it was the name of a snowboarding movie I made for my senior thesis project in college.
Nice.
And when I started my business, and I was like, what am I going to call my company? My mom's like, why don't you use Elegant Seagulls? You already got all the branding and stuff for it, and away she went.
Awesome.
There's a quote on your site that says, on your personal site, IamJackDusty.com, I have been really interested in unique ways to sell products through storytelling versus the traditional e-commerce experience. Talk about that.
What you mean by that?
So you go to a site now, and let me preface one thing is there's a piece of e-commerce where it's conversions and the balance of conversions versus brand and storytelling. But if you go to so many sites now, it's a grid of products and that's it. We've got a hero photo, grid of products. We've got a photo.
Yeah, that's been A/B tested for years and that's what works.
And it works. It works. I get it. But how can you make a relationship where someone has a feeling associated with a product? So I do CrossFit. I love CrossFit. I've been doing it for a couple of years. And I love the comparing myself to these athletes and I know what I'm going through these workouts, and they're doing them half the time I am. So I'm like, man, look how I can't even imagine this is possible, but I can at least put myself in their shoes. No pun intended for the Nike mock that I did, but it's something where I can feel like I'm a part of that, and I'm a part of this brand, I'm a part of this community, and I need these shoes because, you know, I'm going to this dark place. And so how do you better tell the story of these shoes and better tell the story of how someone's relating to these products through visuals and a story versus just a grid of products? And I don't know if I'd be far from saying I solved the riddle, but it was a fun exploration in how you could do that. And I really think there's going to be an evolution where you see more and more of this from an e-commerce standpoint.
I mean, it makes sense on the whole, like, circle of why thing. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. Some people call it, like, the golden circle. Like, on the outside is what it is. And on the like, there's a layer in between, which I kind of forget right now.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah. The very center is the why. So yeah. You're sort of like you're buying something because of the why, because of what, you know, you expect it, how you expect it to make you feel.
Yep, exactly.
So it does. I like that approach. It's just sort of non-traditional. And the other thing that's great about it is it sort of treats humans like we're humans. Like, we're communicating the same way that we've always communicated through storytelling. And I think that's pretty cool. I mean, I didn't rehearse that or anything. I was just kind of thinking about it.
How no, you, I, you're saying, I, mean, I think You probably verbalized it better than I did. But I think we are both in agreement that, that conceptually, it's a great way to tie a product to more than just what the product is, the higher goal and the higher thinking and like what it's about. So, you know, the shoe is just the one example, but there's a real emotional connection with that.
So like in the studio, you know, say you're working with a brand, let's say you were working with Nike, and you know, how do you guys uncover those special moments that can be told in a story? And then I guess even more importantly, like you're working on designs, like how do you present it to tell that story versus like, you know, the typical, you know, design review where you're just like looking at options and looking at the differences. Do you, when you present these concepts, is there something more behind just the screens than that 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 support that direction?
So, yeah. As far as internally, that we still do the same critiquing you would do probably traditionally, and that doesn't really change. It's just how I think how you look at it. But as far as presenting to the clients, it probably takes a bit more pitch to sell them on the idea and why we did it and what the rationale is and how it's going to help and how it's going to promote. But more often than not, when someone sees it, they relate to it and they get it. And if they don't get it, they're probably going to go with option A, the safe option. So,
yeah.
So, I mean, if they see it and they're like, wow, they're going to get a gut. The best reaction I can have from a client is they see it and they're like, wow, you get it, or you got it. And for me, it's the biggest high and the biggest rush as a designer when you hear that from a client and know that you nailed it. And you did. You read between the lines. You put yourselves in their shoes. You took a risk, and it paid off. And for me, it's a huge part of what drives my passion for design.
That's really awesome. I mean, how do you how would you respond to someone that says, oh, man, like, I really get that, but you know, my background tells me that, you know, I should probably, you know, following the format that all these other e-commerce sites have, and you know, my boss is gonna like grill me on conversions and stuff like that. Like, what if they really, really get it, but they're scared to do it?
We get that often, and it's a tough thing to overcome, and it's still important. I don't want to portray the wrong message and say we're not still considering conversions, because there's really no point in having the store if you're not going to sell anything. So,
right.
But it's probably finding that safe balance between the two. So we might, a lot of times we swing for the fences and it gets pared back, but that story isn't lost. So,
whoa, I'd love to see the stuff that's out in left field then.
Yeah. <That's>, so, but it, or it could just be more focused message or, you know, quicker calls to action. And and sometimes sites evolve and that's fine too, but you can still take pieces away that have injected that personality and, but still have that super high traditional conversion standpoint. So a lot of times it's that gray area.
So I didn't expect to have this conversation, but since we've been talking about it, it's, you know, I have to ask you, like, what about writing? You know, like, are your designers skilled writers? Do you have writers on the team? You know, because
do you mean like copywriting?
Yeah, yeah.
Or do you mean,
I mean, in addition to
marketing,
like great visuals, you know, a lot sometimes storytelling is, you know, the personality, you know, is in words or the voice and tone or some, you know, sometimes literally like written, you know, messages. Like,
we'll work with clients.
Are you guys good writers?
No, I am not. So, I am probably good at writing tags and headlines and high level sort of directives to guide someone through a page. But as far as the actual body copy, you don't want me touching that. If you see my spelling and my grammar, you know, you'd be laughable. But the team, we will help craft some language for clients internally, but we don't actually have a copywriter on staff. We will work with copywriters though, and help shape that voice.
I mean,
the voice
kind of
is
off topic, but I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say that the voice, though, to your point, is super important. I mean, all those pieces play together. So, I mean, when you're thinking about the whole experience of creating a really memorable and personality-driven site, it's the design, it's the tiny details, it's the motion enhancements, it's everything coming together that really is going to create a overall immersive piece that someone really remembers.
I was talking to Joshua Taylor, who's going to be on the show soon. He used to work at Evernote at the time that I was there. I guess he was, I think his role was head of design, but over beers one time he told me, like, you know, the vision for his new agency that he was starting was to have a, you know, an engineer, a designer, and a writer on every project.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be the dream, right?
If
money wasn't a concern.
So, how do you, can you give some advice to people that, I don't know, maybe people that are in agencies? Because what you're saying that you're doing is a lot easier said than done. I'm sure
there's some pain
points. Well, I just mean, even backing up further to, like, the, you're very selective about the clients or the work you put out there and stuff. And you want to make sure that you're in line with the same message as your clients. Like, how do you do that? Because, you know, sometimes, like, you got to pay the bills and you're like, you've got this client that's ready to, you know, give a great payday, you know, but it's just like work that you maybe don't believe in or something like that. I think a lot of designers struggle with that because we all want like purpose and like great work and to work for brands that we really believe in. But how do you build a business and maintain that selectivity while also like running a successful business? I'd love to hear you talk about that if you have any thoughts on it. I'm sure it's...
Yeah, no, that's... Yeah. You guys are asking good questions, keeping my toes here. So part of that, I mean, we still take on projects that end up being not as exciting for us. And we talked about that earlier on in the conversation. But we do still try to really put our, how can we still make this exciting and creative, but for the client, even if it does become not what we originally envisioned. We've been very, very lucky to grown slowly enough where we have taken leaps as any business would, but haven't taken giant, incredible strides at one time, so we can stay selective. So, for example, we could probably be doing twice as many projects as we are right now. And I don't mean that to sound cocky, but I just mean we get a lot of inquiries, but they don't align creatively, they don't align budget-wise, whatever it might be. And so we can be more selective from that standpoint. If we didn't have that flexibility to be more selective, we would have to take on a lot of projects that probably didn't fit necessarily as much in our wheelhouse or as much as like in the projects we're looking to tackle. And that's okay. And we probably will still have times when we have to do that. So, but it's being very careful pre-vetting. And it goes back to just instinct of being careful when you're talking with clients and asking the right questions and trusting your gut, knowing when to say no. I wish 5 years ago I could go back to myself and say, Ben, say no. Like, that I was like, whoever, you know, could have given me that advice, it would have made my life a lot easier. So that would have been a huge piece. But taking risks, have this client that doesn't sound exciting and take a risk and do an extra concept and make it amazing. And if it doesn't work out, you kept your design team engaged and excited and going for it, and you're pushing them. And so you not only did you push your team, you gave the client something unexpected or even extra. And on top of that, maybe that's what they'll go with. And that's how I would solve the problem. That's how I think we approach it now.
Is it tempting when offers for bigger contracts that you're not necessarily interested in are, you know, we could probably just take that staff up and, you know, keep working on interesting stuff, but have a bigger team and build your business to be a larger agency than nine. Is that ever tempting, or is that just not even a thought?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we'll probably... We've been as big as 10 or 11, and we'll be up to 10 probably here shortly again. But I don't really have a goal to have a gigantic agency, partly because I like being working closely with my team. I like staying agile and lean and mean. I love being selective with the projects we pick and keeping my team happy. We could take on a lot more projects and have a lot more people and my team would be unhappy. And that sounds, I'm sure you guys can relate to that. When you take on projects and the team gets bogged down and is over it and burnt out or not engaged versus taking on projects that keep people excited and taking on not too many projects at the same time. So you become overwhelmed. That was a problem I've definitely made in the past where it's easy to say, yeah, we'll do it. And all of a sudden you're like, oh man, we got lots of projects. So, and you
well,
don't.
I like what you're doing too, like the idea of having multiple designers on a project. I mean, because aside from the project itself, you could probably do more work just by spreading your team thin.
Yeah.
And we're in the same boat, you know, we've invested intentionally in the growth that we had. We're the size we are now. We don't necessarily need to be this size, but we invested in some growth just so we could ensure that every project had two or three collaborators at all times.
Yep, I love that.
To work together, you know. And I think that's cool that you do that too.
Yeah, it seems like you guys, we have similar mindsets in a lot of our philosophies from just bits and pieces that I've heard about you guys. So,
oh, let's hang out.
I need to. I'm in.
So Rick, I think it was Rick the other day that suggested, or maybe it was someone else, that we start doing some designer exchanges with other studios.
Oh, that'd be crazy.
A foreign design exchange.
Yeah, like a foreign design studio. Like we'll send one of our designers to be an Elegant Seagulls member for a month. You send a designer here to be a fun sizer for a month.
Oh my god, I legitimately love that idea, and I guarantee you, I would have people that would be jumping at the opportunity. So.
Man, if we did that, I think, man, that would be really cool. Like, I've never heard of that.
No poaching. But
you might have come up with a game-changing idea. I love it. It's very cool.
Yeah, you may have.
I mean, it's a cool way to learn, too, and see how, you know, how does your team work and adapt and versus our team. So we'll have to keep this idea brewing for sure.
All right, let's talk about that on Slack.
That's pretty cool. Well, we should probably wrap up. We're a little bit over time. But man, Ben, it's been a great, I've had a great time talking to you.
No, me too. I had a blast. I kind of just zoned out. We were just chatting. So it was awesome.
Yep.
Made my afternoon.
It's beautiful.
Thanks for making your first podcast appearance.
Oh, this is your first podcast appearance. Awesome.
First one, guys. So thank you. It's been an honor.
Sweet. Well, congratulations on your 10 years, man. That's an absolute amazing accomplishment.
Thank you so much.
Especially in the design agency world. That's like, you guys are like...
Yep.
I'm getting old. I'm getting old, I guess.
Man, please, can you tell our listeners like where they can find you, learn more about Elegant Seagulls or Jack Dusty, Twitter, that sort of thing?
Yeah, so elegantseagulls.com. Please check us out there, and I'm jackdusty.com, and that's probably the big ones. We're on all the social. Twitter is Elegant Seagulls, and Facebook, we're all over the interweb, so I hope people check us out.
Cool.
Thanks, Ben.
That's all great. Right. Thanks a lot.
Hey, man. Thanks, guys. Take care.
Yeah, you too.
Awesome.
Hey, thanks so much for listening today. This is Rick. I'm sure you've all heard of Envision. The product is practically synonymous with screen design. We're stoked that Envision is now a sponsor of Hustle. Something we love about Envision is that they are so highly involved in the community. These guys really care about where design is going, and they support creatives with loads of design resources, UI kits, design process, and interview articles on their blog, which is great for just general inspiration when building products. Aside from being a great prototyping tool, they also have features for project management, creating mood boards and presentations, live collaborative screen sharings, and like a million other useful things. I literally do not have enough time to even list all their features, but they pretty much got what you need. Bottom line, they don't just want you to be a user. They want to empower you with their tools so that you can do your best work. And I think that's pretty cool. Overall takeaway, if you haven't heard about Envision or haven't checked them out in a while, just play around with their latest features. They have a free trial and a really impressive lineup of industry-leading design and project management tools. Their homepage is just envisionapp.com. Go check them out. Hustle is brought to you by Funsize, a digital product design agency in Austin, Texas that creates delightful, innovative products for mobile, web, and beyond. Visit us on Twitter @Funsize or visit our website at funsize.co.